morning and welcome to today's first solo reading by Miriam Tagues. Please be aware that this session will be taped for possible use on non-commercial radio. Miriam has agreed to a question and answer session after the reading. Miriam Tagues has written 5 books of fiction: Summer of My Amazing Luck, A Boy of Good Breeding, A Complicated Kindness, The Flying Troutmans, and Irma Voth, as well as a nonfiction book, Swing Low, A Life. Her last book, All My Puny Sorrows, published in 2014, is a combination of fact and fiction. Her work has brought accolades galore. A Complicated Kindness was chosen for Canada Reads 2006 and Canada Reads Canadian Bestseller of the Decade 2010. She's a winner of the Governor General's Literary Award for Fiction, the CBA Libris Award for Fiction Book of the Year, the Rogers Trust Fiction Prize, and the Writers Trust Marion Engel Timothy Finley Award. Wow. Today she'll read from All My Puny Sorrows, a story of two sisters whose love for each other is tortured by fear of loss. It's funny and terribly sad. It broke my heart and made me guffaw with laughter. Please welcome Miriam Tagues.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for that introduction. We got that? Okay. This is great. It's so wonderful to be on this beautiful island. How fortunate we are. I just had breakfast looking off at that other island. There are islands all around. I don't know if you've noticed, but I don't know what they're called, but they're all beautiful. This is a special place, and it's so good to be here. Thank you for having me, and thanks to the Paisleys for putting us up, and to Dee Dee for getting me here. Okay, for some reason I'm in the middle of my book. I'm going to read from All My Puny Sorrows, and I'm going to read the first chapter. And to tell you the truth, I've never read this first chapter in its entirety. I've always read the part of the first chapter and then I've stopped, but I'm going to read the whole first chapter, and then we'll have questions. Hopefully you'll have some questions and I'll try my best to answer them. Also, I just have reading glasses now. This is the first time in my life. Mortality. I didn't think it was going to happen to me, but... this book, Amps, I like to call it, is... they're reading glasses, so there we go. Okay, scientific. It's about two sisters, and it's about love. When I set out to write this book, I didn't set out to write a book that was going to be about, for instance, assisted dying, or that was going to become a social issue book or anything like that. It was just simply a book that I wanted to write about my sister, about myself, about our relationship, and about the final few months of my sister's life when she. Died when she took her own life in 2010. I thought I wouldn't write again. That was it. I had no words, and then eventually realized that I would have to write about it. So this is that book. Let's see. There was something else that I was going to say about it. I've been talking about this book for the last 2 years, but still, every time I talk about it, it seems to leave me, you know, verklempt a little bit. But. The book, again, about two sisters, and it's love, but it's a specific love. I think the question at the heart of the book is how do we love somebody who wants to die? Chapter 1. And the book is written from the point of view of the younger sister, whose name is Yolandi, and the older sister's name is Elfrida. Our house was taken away on the back of a truck one afternoon, late in the summer of 1979. My parents and my older sister and I stood in the middle of the street and watched it disappear, a low-slung bungalow made of wood and brick and plaster, slowly making its way down First Street, past the A&W and the deluxe bowling lanes, and out onto the number 12 highway, where we eventually lost sight of it. I can still see it, said my sister Elfrida, repeatedly, until finally she couldn't. I can still see it. I can still see it. I can still... Okay, nope, it's gone, she said. My father had built it himself back when he had a new bride, both of them barely 20 years old, and a dream. My mother told Elfrida and me that she and my father were so young and so exploding with energy that on hot evenings, just as soon as my father had finished teaching school for the day and my mother had finished the baking and everything else, they'd go running through the sprinkler in their new front yard, whooping and leaping, completely oblivious to the stares and consternation of their older neighbors, who thought it unbecoming of a newly married Mennonite couple to be cavorting, half-dressed, in full view of the entire town. Years later, Elfrida would describe the scene as my parents' La Dolce Vita moment and the sprinkler as their Trevi fountain. Where's it going? I asked my father. We stood in the center of the road. The house was gone. My father made a visor with his hand to block the sun's glare. I don't know, he said. He didn't want to know. Elfrida and my mother and I got into our car and waited for my father to join us. He stood looking at emptiness for what seemed like an eternity to me. Elfrida complained that the backs of her legs were burning up on the hot plastic seat. Finally, my mother reached over and honked the horn, only slightly, not enough to startle my father, but to make him turn and look at us. It was such a hot summer, and we had a few days to kill before we could move into our new house, which was similar to our old house, but not one that my father had built himself with loving attention to every detail, such as a long covered porch to sit in and watch electrical storms while remaining dry. And so my parents decided we should go camping in the Badlands of South Dakota. We spent the whole time, it seemed, setting everything up and then tearing it all down. My sister, Elfrida, said it wasn't really life. It was like being in a mental hospital where everyone walked around with the sole purpose of surviving and conserving energy. It was like being in a refugee camp. It was a halfway house for recovering neurotics. It was this and that. She didn't like camping. And our mother said, well, honey, it's meant to alter our perception of things. Paris would do that too, said Elf or LSD. And our mother said, come on, the point is we're all together. Let's cook our wieners. The propane stove had an oil leak and exploded into 4-foot flames and charred the picnic table. But while that was happening, Elfrida danced around the fire singing Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks, a song about a black sheep saying goodbye to everyone because he's dying. And our father swore for the first recorded time, wet in the Sam Hills, and stood close to the fire, poised to do something, but what? What? And our mother stood there shaking, laughing, unable to speak. I yelled at my family to move away from the fire, but nobody moved an inch as if they had been placed in their positions by a movie director, and the fire was only fake, and the scene would be ruined if they moved. Then I grabbed the half-empty rainbow ice cream pail that was sitting on the picnic table and ran across the field to a communal tap and filled the pail with water and ran back and threw the water onto the flames, which leapt higher then, mingled with a sense of vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry, towards the branches of an overhanging poplar tree. A branch sparked into fire, but only briefly, because by then the skies had darkened and suddenly rain and hail began their own swift assault. And we were finally safe. At least from fire. That evening, after the storm had passed and the faulty propane stove had been tossed into a giant cougar-proof garbage cage, my father and my sister decided to attend a lecture on what was once thought to be the extinct black-footed ferret. It was being held in the amphitheater of the campground, and they said they might stick around for the second lecture as well, which was being given by an expert in astrophysics about the nature of dark matter. What is that? I asked my sister, and she said she didn't know, but she thought it constituted a large part of the universe. You can't see it, she said, but you can feel its effects or something. Is it evil? I asked her. She laughed, and I remember perfectly, or should I say I have a perfect memory, of how she looked standing there in her hot pants and striped halter top with a shadowy, eroded Badlands behind her, her head back, way back, her long, thin neck and its white leather choker with a blue bead in the center, her burst of laughter like a volley of warning shots, a challenge to the world to come and get her if it dared. She and my father walked off towards the amphitheater, my mother calling out to them, make kissing sounds to ward off rattlesnakes. And while they were gone and learning about invisible forces and extinction, my mother and I stayed beside the tent and played What Time Is It, Mr. Wolf? against the last remaining blotches of the setting sun. On the way home from the campground, we were quiet. We had driven for 2.5 days in a strange direction that took us away from East Village, until finally my father had said, "Well, fair enough. I suppose we ought to return home now," as though he had been trying to work something out and then had simply given up. We sat in the car, looking solemnly through open windows at the dark, jagged outcroppings of the Great Canadian Shield. "Unforgiving," said my father, almost imperceptibly. And when my mother asked him what he had said, he pointed at the rock, and she nodded, "Ah," but without conviction, as though she had hoped he'd meant something else, something they could defy, the two of them. "What are you thinking about?" I whispered to Elf. The wind whipped our hair into a frenzy, hers black, mine yellow. We were in the back seat, stretched out lengthwise, our legs entangled, our backs against the doors. Elf was reading Difficult Loves by Italo Calvino. "If you weren't reading right now, what would you be thinking about?" I asked again. "A revolution," she said. I asked her what she meant, and she said I'd see someday. She couldn't tell me now. "A secret revolution?" I asked her. Then she said in a loud voice, so we could all hear her, "Let's not go back." Nobody responded. The wind blew. Nothing changed. My father wanted to stop to see ancient Aboriginal ochre paintings on the rock escarpments that hugged Lake Superior. They had endured mysteriously against the harsh elements of sun and water and time. My father stopped the car, and we walked down a narrow, rocky path towards the lake. There was a sign that said "Danger," and in small letters explained that people had been known to be swept off these rocks by giant rogue waves, and that we were responsible for our own safety. We passed several of these signs on our way to the water, and with each dire warning, the already deep furrow in my father's brow became deeper and deeper, until my mother told him, "Jake, relax, you'll give yourself a stroke." When we got to the rocky shore, we realized that in order to see the pictographs, one had to inch along slippery, wet granite that plunged several meters into the foamy water, and then hang onto a thick rope that was secured with spikes driven into the rock, and then lean way back over the lake, almost to the point of being horizontal, with your hair grazing the water. "Well," said my father, "we're not about to do that, are we?" He read the plaque next to the trail, hoping that its contents would suffice. "Ah," he said, "the rock researcher who discovered these paintings called them Forgotten Dreams." My father looked at my mother then. "Did you hear that, Lottie?" he asked. "Forgotten Dreams." He took a small notebook from his pocket and wrote down this detail. But Elf was completely enchanted with the idea of suspending her body on a rope over crashing water, and before anybody could stop her, she was gone. My parents called to her to come back, to be careful, to use some common sense, to behave herself, to get back now. And I stood silent and wide-eyed, watching in horror what I believed would be the watery end of my intrepid sister. She clung to the rope and gazed at the paintings. We couldn't see them from where we stood. And then she described to us what she was seeing, which was mostly images of strange, spiny creatures and other cryptic symbols of a proud, prolific nation. When we did, finally, all four of us, arrive back alive in our small town that lay just on the far western side of the Rocky Shield in the middle of blue and yellow fields, we weren't relieved. We were in our new house now. My father could sit in his lawn chair in the front yard and see, through the trees across the highway to First Street, the empty spot where our old house had been. He hadn't wanted his house to be taken away. It wasn't his idea. But the owner of the car dealership next door wanted the property to expand his parking lot and made all sorts of voluble threats and exerted relentless pressure until finally my father couldn't take it anymore and he buckled one day and sold it to the car dealer for a song, as my mother put it. "It's just business, Jake," said the car dealer to my father the next Sunday in church. "It's nothing personal." East Village had originated as a godly refuge from the vices of the world, but somehow these two, religion and commerce, had become inextricably linked, and the wealthier the inhabitants of East Village became, the more pious they also became, as though religious devotion was believed to be rewarded with the growth of business and the accumulation of money, and the accumulation of money was believed to be blessed by God, so that when my father objected to selling his home to the car dealer, there was in the air a whiff of accusation that perhaps by holding out, my father wasn't being a good Christian. This was the implication. And above all, my father wanted to be a good Christian.
My mother encouraged him to fight, to tell the car dealer to take a hike. And Elfrida, being older than me and more aware of what was going on, tried to get a petition going amongst the villagers to keep businesses from expanding into people's homes, but there was nothing that could be done to assuage my father's persistent guilt and the feeling that he'd be sinning if he were to fight for what was his in the first place. And besides, my father was thought to be an anomaly in East Village, an oddball, a quiet, depressive, studious guy who went for 10-mile walks in the countryside and believed that reading and writing and reason were the tickets to paradise. My mother would fight for him, although only up to a point, because she was, after all, a loyal Mennonite wife and didn't want to upset the apple cart of domestic hierarchy. But she was a woman anyway, so very easily overlooked. Now, in our new house, my mother was restless and dreamy. My father slammed things around in the garage. I spent my days building volcanoes in the backyard or roaming the outskirts of our town, stalking the perimeter like a caged chimp. An elf began working on increasing her visibility. She had been inspired by the ochre paintings on the rock, by their impermeability and their mixed message of hope, reverence, defiance, and eternal aloneness. She decided she too would make her mark. She came up with a design that incorporated her initials, EVR, Elfrida von Reason, and below those, the initials AMP. Then, like a coiled snake, the letter S, which covered, underlined, and dissected the other letters. She showed me what it looked like on a yellow legal notepad. I said, I don't get it. Well, she told me, the initials of my name are obviously the initials of my name, and the AMP stands for all my puny, then the big S stands for sorrows, which encloses all the other letters. She made a fist with her right hand and punched the open palm of her left hand. She had a habit then of punctuating all her stellar ideas with a punch from herself to herself. How'd you come up with it? I asked her. She told me that she'd gotten it from a poem by Samuel Coleridge, who would definitely have been her boyfriend if she'd been born when she should have been born. Or if he had, I said. She told me she was going to paint her symbol on various natural landmarks around our town. What natural landmarks, I asked her. Like the water tower, she said, and fences. May I make a suggestion, I asked. She looked at me askance. We both knew there was nothing I could offer her in the way of making one's mark in the world. That would be like some acolyte of Jesus saying, hey, you managed to feed only 5,000 people with one fish and two loaves of bread. Well, check this out. But she was feeling magnanimous just then, the excitement of her achievement, and she nodded enthusiastically. Don't use your own initials, I said, because everyone in town will know whose they are, and then the fires of hell will raineth down on us, etc. Our little Mennonite town was against overt symbols of hope and individual signature pieces. Our church pastor once accused Elf of luxuriating in the afflictions of her own wanton emotions, to which she responded, bowing low with an extravagant sweep of her arm, mea culpa, my lord. Back then, Elf was always starting campaigns. She conducted a door-to-door survey to see how many people in town would be interested in changing the name of it from East Village to Shangri-La, and managed to get over 100 signatures by telling people the name was from the Bible and meant a place of no pride. maybe, she said, I might just write amps with a very large S. It'll be more mysterious, she said, more je ne sais quoi. Precisely, I said. But don't you love it? I do, I said, and your boyfriend Samuel Coleridge would be happy about it too. She made a sudden karate chop slice through the air and then stared into the distance as though she'd just heard the far-off rattle of enemy fire. Yeah, she said, like objective sadness, which is something else. Something else than what? I asked her. Yoli, she said, then subjective sadness, obviously. Oh yeah, I said, I mean, obviously. There are still red spray-painted amps in East Village today, although they are fading. They are fading faster than the hardy Aboriginal ochre pictographs that inspired them. Elfrida has a fresh cut just above her left eyebrow. There are 7 stitches holding her forehead together. The stitches are black and stiff, and the ends poke out of her head like little antennae. I asked her how she got that cut, and she told me that she fell in the washroom. Who knows if that's true or false? We are women in our 40s now. Much has happened and not happened. Elf said that in order for her to open her packages of pills, the ones given to her by the nurses, she would need a pair of scissors. Fat lie. I told her that I knew she wasn't interested in taking the pills anyway, unless they were of such a volume that their combined effect would make her heart seize, so why would she need a pair of scissors to open the package? Also, she could use her hands to tear it open. But she won't risk injuring her hands. Elfrida's a concert pianist. When we were kids, she would occasionally let me be her page turner for the fast pieces that she hadn't memorized. Page turning is a particular art. I had to be just ahead of her in the music and move like a snake when I turned the page, so there was no crinkling and no sticking and no thwopping, her words. She made me practice over and over, her ear just 2 inches from the page, listening. Heard it, she'd say. And I'd have to do it again until she was satisfied that I hadn't made the slightest sound. I liked the idea of being ahead of her in something. I took real pride in creating a seamless passage for her from one page to the next. There's a perfect moment for turning the page, and if I was too early or too late, Elfrida would stop playing and howl. The last measure, she'd say, only at the last measure. Then her arms and head would crash onto the keys, and she'd hold her foot to on the sustaining pedal so that her suffering would resonate eerily throughout the house. Shortly after that camping incident, and after Elf had gone around town with her red paint, making her mark, the bishop, the Alpha Mennonite, came to our house for what he liked to call a visit. Sometimes he referred to himself as a cowboy and these encounters as mending fences. But in reality, it was more of a raid. He showed up on a Saturday in a convoy with his usual posse of elders, each in his own black hardtop car. They never carpool because it's not as effective in creating terror when 13 or 14 similarly dressed men tumble out of one car. And my father and I watched from the window as they parked in front of our house and got out of their cars and walked slowly towards us, one behind the other, like a tired conga line. My mother was in the kitchen washing dishes. She knew they were coming, but was intentionally ignoring them, passing off their visit as a minor inconvenience that wouldn't interfere too much with her day. It was the same bishop who had reprimanded my mother for wearing a wedding dress that was too full and billowy at the bottom. How am I to interpret this excess? He'd asked her. My sister was somewhere in the house, probably working on her Black Panther look or re-piercing her ears with a potato and rubbing alcohol or staring down demons. My father went to the door and ushered the men into our home. They all sat down in the living room and looked at the floor or occasionally at each other. My father stood alone with panicky eyes in the middle of the room, surrounded like the sole remaining survivor of a strange game of dodgeball. My mother should have come out of the kitchen immediately, all bustle and warmth, and offered the men coffee or tea in some type of elaborate homemade pastry culled from the Mennonite Treasury cookbook. But instead, she remained where she was, clanking dishes, whistling with a forced nonchalance, leaving my father to fight alone. They had argued about this before. Jake, she'd said, when they come here, tell them it's not a convenient time. They have no right to march into our home willy-nilly. He said he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. So my mother had offered to do it, and he had begged her not to until she agreed, but said she wouldn't bounce around waiting on them hand and foot while they laid out plans for her family's crucifixion. This particular visit was about Elf planning to go to university to study music. She was only 15, but the authorities had heard from a local snitch that Elf had expressed an indiscreet longing to leave the community, and they were apoplectically suspicious of higher learning, especially for girls. Public enemy number one for these men was a girl with a book. She'll get ideas, said one of them to my father in our living room, to which he had no response but to nod in agreement and look longingly towards the kitchen where my mother was staked out, snapping her dish towel at houseflies and pounding baby veal into schnitzel. I sat silently beside my father on the itchy Davenport, absorbing their perfume of contempt, as my mother described it. I heard my mother call my name. I went into the kitchen and found her sitting on the counter, swinging her legs and chugging apple juice straight from the plastic jug. Where's Elf? She asked me. I shrugged. How should I know? I hopped up on the counter next to her and she passed me the jug of apple juice. We heard murmuring from the living room, a combination of English and Plattdeutsch, the vaguely Dutch sounding and unwritten medieval language spoken by all the old people in East Village. I'm called Jacob von Riesens Yolandi in Plautich, and when my mother introduces herself in Plautich, she says, I am of Jacob von Riesen. Then, after a minute or two had passed, we heard the opening chords of Rachmaninoff's Prelude in G minor, Opus 23. Elf was in the spare bedroom, next to the front door where the piano was, where her life mostly took place in those days. The men stopped talking. The music got louder. It was Elf's favorite piece, the soundtrack to her secret revolution, perhaps. She'd been working on it for 2 years, nonstop, with a teacher from the conservatory in Winnipeg who drove to our house twice a week to give her lessons, and my parents and I were familiar with every one of its nuances, its agony, its ecstasy, its total respect for the importance of the chaotic ramblings of an interior monologue. Elf had described it to us. Pianos weren't even allowed in our town, technically, too reminiscent of saloons and speakeasies and unbridled joy. But my parents snuck it into the house anyway, because a doctor in the city had suggested that Elf be given a creative outlet for her energies to prevent her from becoming wild. And that word had sinister implications. Wild was the worst thing you could become in a community rigged for compliance. After a few years of having a secret piano, hastily covered with sheets and gunny sacks when the elders came to visit, my parents grew to love Elf's playing and even made occasional requests along the way, like Moon River and When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. Eventually, the elders did find out that we were harboring a piano in our house, and there was a long discussion about it, of course, and some talk of a 3-month or 6-month excommunication for my father, who offered to take it like a man, but when he appeared to go down so willingly, they decided to let it go. Meeting out punishment isn't fun when the victim asks for it. As long as my parents oversaw that Elf was using the piano only as an instrument for the Lord. My mother began to hum along, her body began to sway. The men in the living room remained silent, as though they were being reprimanded. Elf played louder, then quieter, then louder again. The birds stopped singing, and the flies in the kitchen stopped slamming up against the windows. The air was still. She was at the center of the spinning world. This was the moment Elf took control of her life. It was her debut as an adult woman. And although we didn't know it at the time, her debut also as a world-class pianist. I like to think that in that moment, it became clear to the men in the living room that she wouldn't be able to stay, not after the expression of so much passion and tumult. And furthermore, that to hold her there, she would have to be burned at the stake or buried alive. It was the moment Elf left us. And it was the moment my father lost everything all at once, approval from the elders, his authority as head of the household, and his daughter, who was now free and therefore dangerous. The opus came to an end and we heard the piano top slam shut over the keys and the piano bench scrape the linoleum floor in the spare bedroom. Elf came into the kitchen and I passed her the jug of apple juice and she drank it all, finished it off and chucked the container into the garbage can. She punched a fist into her palm and said, "Finally nailed it." We three stood in the kitchen while the men in suits filed out of our house in the order they had filed in and we heard the front door close softly and the men's car engines start, and the cars pull away from the curb and disappear. We waited for my father to join us in the kitchen, but he had gone to his study. I'm still not sure whether or not Elf knew that the men were in the living room, or even that the bishop and the elders had paid us a visit at all, or if it was just a coincidence that she chose that exact time to play the Rachmaninoff piece to fierce perfection. But shortly after the visit from the bishop and his men, Elf made a painting and put it in an old frame she'd found in the basement. She hung it in the middle of our living room wall, right above the scratchy couch. It was a quote. It read, "I know of a certainty that a proud, haughty, avaricious, selfish, unchaste, lecherous, wrangling, envious, disobedient, idolatrous, false, lying, unfaithful, thievish, defaming, backbiting, bloodthirsty, unmerciful, and revengeful man, whosoever he may be, is no Christian, even if he was baptized 100 times and attended the Lord's Supper daily." Menno Simons. "Okay, but Elfie," said my mom. "Nope," said Elfie. "It's staying right there. It's the word of Menno Simons. Aren't we supposed to be following them?" Elfie's new artwork hung in our living room for about a week until my father asked her, "Well, kiddo, have you made your point? I'd really love to put Mum's embroidered steam chick back in that spot." And by then, her righteous indignation had blown over like so many of her wild personal storms. Thank you.
Miriam will take some questions now, but could I remind you to use your big people voices? Because you can hear her, but she won't be able to hear you.
There we go. Oh, I got one for you, too. Yes, exactly. Please do, if you have any questions, and if I can see you, just holler from wherever you are. There we go.
First of all, thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, the stigma, like you say, the stigma surrounding mental illness is still so huge. It's people, we all are collectively trying to reduce it, and I think some steps in that direction are being made, but there's so much fear around it. It's a terrifying thing. It can and has happened to, I'm sure, many of us in this room and to the people that we love, it's really, really scary to think that, you know, I'm losing my mind. My best friend is losing his mind. What could be worse? And so, you know, I think our human instinct is to just sort of shy away from the stuff that scares us, and then, you know, as a result, we're not talking about it. We're not researching it as we should be. We're not funding it. So certainly the stigma of that was something that, and it's something that I've battled against all of my life with my family, trying to advocate for them, trying to help, and we've all been trying to help each other in that regard, and it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult. I've talked so much about my feelings about, you know, the mental health care, the system in this country, how broken it is, but I do feel optimistic. I feel that very, very slowly, maybe not in our lifetime, but, you know, maybe in the lifetime of our children or grandchildren, that there will be changes. A friend of mine and I were talking the other day, and another friend had just kind of admitted himself into care at CAMH and in Toronto, and just how sort of horrifying and humiliating and scary that process was for him. And we were saying, why is it like that? Why shouldn't there be, you know, a red carpet, you know, gift bags, a welcome committee, you know, like, we're so proud of you, welcome, we're here to take care of you, we're so proud of you, you've decided that you need help and you've come and we're here to help you. I mean, you know, we were obviously kind of joking around a little bit because, you know, as if, right? But it's really good, you know, it's really good to dream about these things, to imagine. I think, you know, like Ursula Le Guin said, we can't have freedom until we imagine freedom. And it's the same thing with anything, you know, whether it's better mental health care. We need to imagine it. We need to plan.
Understand.
Not necessarily. I've come to understand that. At this point in my writing, I've come to understand, what books, and of course, as a reader, you know, I knew how much they affected me and how much strength they gave me, or that I was able to relate. I could see myself reflected back to myself, and I felt less alone, which is the first point of reading and writing. But when I wrote A Complicated Kindness, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I feel that, you know, when I'm writing, I'm working stuff out. I have questions, I have obsessions that I'm working out in my work. And the point, the goal, of course, always is for that to resonate with readers so that we can form that community. But it, you know, it doesn't occur, it certainly didn't occur to me with A Complicated Kindness that, you know, that book would be something that would help somebody else, you know, I'm not sure, just feel less alone in that kind of a community, or even liberate themselves from that kind of a community, feel brave in speaking out, in being themselves. But I certainly have, since writing it, come to understand that, you know, from what people have said to me. There's been a lot of criticism about it too, from people like the elders, you know. And I was, when that book came out, I was really afraid. I wasn't going to not put it out, but I was afraid. I was nervous. I didn't know what was going to happen. Thankfully, Mennonites are pacifists, so they weren't going to. In theory. So, you know, so I didn't feel like there, but at the same time, and in fact, I thought, oh, you know, I really imagined all those cars pulling up and pulling up and pulling up and coming for me. It was a nightmare. It was actually my sister, my late sister, who said to me, I don't have any other sisters, who said to me, you know, Miriam, she said, when A Complicated Kindness came out, she said, okay. She read it. She's like, oh, okay. You know, she was older, smarter, you know, more aware of what was going on. She said, you are going to encounter resistance, you know, and you're going to have to be prepared. And she told me this thing that I have repeated so many times. And she said, okay, this is what you need to say, you know, media, with people, whomever, you know. She said, this isn't a book. It's not a book. It's not a condemnation or a criticism of the Mennonite faith or of the Mennonite people. It's a critique of fundamentalism and of the damage that does to human beings. And so, you know, along those lines. And I repeated that over and over and over and over. And I feel that was exactly the right thing to have said for people to enter into the book, to go along with me in reading it, so that it wasn't just a sort of mockery of Mennonites or of, you know, but that it was a mockery in the one sense, but certainly an indictment of that degree of fundamentalism, of that punishment, the shame, the focus on shame and guilt and punishment and silence.
Comment, really. Mm-hmm. I want to let you know that you have brought me a tremendous amount of pleasure.
Thank you.
In your books, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Every time I read them, I'm just like pulled in with both serious thinking and humor.
Thanks.
So I want to thank you for your braveness and your humor.
Thanks for reading them. You're welcome.
Recognize you? How's it going?
Yeah, I know. Cool. Sorry, what was the question?
Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on now?
Oh no. Next. Okay. It's just another book. It's just another, like, you know, just a little person fighting against the system, kind of. But I appreciate the question. I am working on another book. That's the significant thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you always know you're going to be a writer? And if so, when did you understand that?
Did I always know I was going to be a writer? Certainly not. No, never. It never. I always enjoyed writing. It was my father who was a school teacher, and he loved writing, and he would give me little assignments, often, you know, when I was bored, or and often at the, you know, and in the summertime, and he would say, just write half a full scab of anything at all that you want to write about. And those moments, usually, sometimes I would say, I think I've just figured out something else that I'm going to do. but often I was just so thrilled to be given that, to be given that assignment. And then my father would always mark it. And he'd like sort of pretend to pore over it and like, okay, you know, it's a red pen and okay. And then he'd give me a mark and he'd hand it back to me. It was always an A+. So, very undeserved A+. And so, you know, there was certainly that inspiration there. I thought, for me, I mean, again, seriously, like to grow up in this kind of a community, to be female, I was certainly encouraged to speak my mind and that my opinions were valid and that I had a voice by my family, but the larger community, no. And you know, it didn't seem like something that I could possibly do. I saw all the books lining my father's shelves, my mother's shelves, but I didn't put two and two together that I could. It just seemed not a possibility. And so I knew that I was sort of skirting around it, going to school, studying film, you know, which is obviously storytelling, and then journalism, which is also storytelling. And it was in journalism school, actually, when I started really needing to make things up and to make the story better, you know, that I realized, like, oh, this probably isn't gonna go over very well. And then I realized I'm gonna have to write fiction, you know, about real things, yeah, for that freedom, yeah.
I was a teacher, and I was always concerned, you know, especially when I was near the end of teaching, that there wasn't enough in our school system that reflected Canadian culture. And a lot of where I'm taught in Delta, BC, I think this probably reflects all over British Columbia anyway, a lot of the books that we use were American stories. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Definitely was. I feel that I had a great education, even in, you know, even in my community, which, you know, kind of frowned on certainly on higher education. But again, because of my father and my mother. But like you say, even like within the school, we had a great library. There were books that fueled my imagination. Books were available to us. I think a lot of times there were books in there that had the authorities known they were in there, they would have probably taken off the shelves. But you know, we were savvy, we were hip to that. It's not like we were going to go around saying, "Oh, did you read?" You know, but we were quiet about it. Reading, writing, learning even was kind of a subversive pleasure in a fundamentalist community. It's an act of resistance in a way. And then especially in high school. And now these weren't necessarily. And my older sister also, you know, she had books by Alice Munro, by Margaret Atwood, by Robert Davies, the Canadian sort of icons of literature, and then others as well, lesser known. But then, specifically to your question, the school system, when I was in high school, I read, we were assigned Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment, Dickens, Somerset Maugham, like, books that really just blew my mind. I had no idea that was possible to create something like that with words that would generate that kind of feeling and thought. And so, and that was definitely from within in the school system. Yeah, even in a place like Steinbeck, Manitoba. So I do have faith, and I know that there are people like yourself and others who are constantly advocating for, you know, that kind of thing for Canadian literature, history about ourselves, our stories, also other stuff too, just to, you know, in addition to everything else that we provide for our children, computers, you know, keyboarding, like, you know, that's a class, and, you know, and stuff like that. So again, I'm optimistic.
Highly recommend to anybody who's read it, because then you get to follow, you know, like the aunt and the mom and mm-hmm. what's going on with yeah. them. You're not thinking about plot, so you just get so many other things out of it.
But yeah. Hey, yeah, thanks.
When our book club discussed it, I was dismayed that we spent most of the evening talking about the issue of suicide mm-hmm. and assisted suicide.
Of
and
course.
The ultimate question that we spent most of the evening on was, would you bring an elf to Switzerland?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go back to the literary features of the book, mm-hmm. But it was just too gripping, this mm-hmm. discussion. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, mm-hmm. If that's okay with you, because mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you wrote a piece of fiction, and mm-hmm. you are a fiction writer, and yet the topics that you choose mm-hmm. are such burning issues mm-hmm. That in a way the literary aspect was getting mm-hmm. lost in the discussion at mm-hmm. the time. So I'm just wondering, yeah. how's that for you?
Yeah, it's really nice, like for somebody like yourself who does both, you know, who can I guess. Yeah, I mean the hope is that it is something artful, that it's literary, that it's literature, that it's but whatever kind of conversation it generates and discussion is something that's out of my hands, and whatever kind of discussion it can generate is I'm so happy I'm just so happy about that. That is the point, you know, that it so that we can talk and we can share and we can think and we can think about and to make my readers. I have to say, my ego or whatever it is, you know, of course I do like the recognition that it's a that it's artful, but I feel that at the end, you know, if I can make my readers sort of implicit with my character, with my main character, what is Yolandi gonna do? What should she have done? What should we all do? What should we have done? And in this book, in All My Puny Sorrows, that is a specific question. What are our responsibilities to somebody that we love when that individual has requested in a very sane, lucid, articulate way that that he or she wants to die? And so any conversation around that, I'm just grateful that those conversations are happening, absolutely. Yeah.
I love the book. All the way through, although I know it wasn't memoir, had this anxiety for you about writing about your sister and the responsibility you had taken on in doing that. And I was anxious all the time wondering, what would she think about this book? And I wonder what you think she would think about it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I know, I think about that all the time. Writing about my sister. So I think that, on the one hand, I mean, she knows, you know, we're sisters, we were close. We understand each other. She would know that I would need to do something like this. She would want me to do whatever it took for me to go on, to survive. And I do need, very literally, to write to survive. So in that way, she would be supportive. She was always one of my first readers and a type of muse. A lot of my books have that sister relationship. I don't have any other siblings. And she was older than me, so she had a profound impact on me. And I was always, she suffered, she was so intriguing to me. She was this planet, like this kind of dark, but then sometimes like the sun, you know, but that I kind of, as a lesser planet, just sort of revolved around her, you know, or she revolved around, I'm not sure exactly how astronomy works, whatever, but, but you know what I mean? And so, but also because she was very well read and one of my first readers, I knew that, you know, the standards, aside from the fact that I was writing about her and writing about me and writing about our lives and my mother too, you know, the standard of the writing had to be to such a degree that I had to imagine what she would be saying about that, you know, and particularly, you know, the jokes or the humor, the comedy had to be right there, you know. I had to know, I would remember her words again, like, Miriam, sometimes you go with your joke and you're imagining people laughing, and you love that, fair enough, you know, but you're going, and you're taking it here, and you're taking it, go back, stop right there, you know, and let the reader's imagination do the rest of it, and it'll be better, trust me, you know, things like that, right, that I try to remember, yeah. Yeah.
I know it's fiction, but the details, the day-to-day
No. It would have been, like I said, I mean, you know, during that time, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to have written down my own street address. I mean, it was, you know how it is, you're just in that, you know, you're at war, and you're in the trenches, and you're trying to, so it wasn't, I didn't have any thought. There are certainly experiences in my life where I'm a little bit detached, where I'm kind of experiencing them and thinking, you know, hey, I think this might work for my, you know, for my own purposes, but something like that, no, I didn't. I was memory, and, you know, it was so kind of burned into. It's funny when people say, oh, so you've written this book. Okay, so you've dealt with that stuff. So it's therapeutic. That was cathartic. You know, and I think we all know, we've all suffered, we've all lost, that's simply, you know, it just doesn't work that way. It's not true. We writing this, you know, it became something that helped to figure out how to go on. But certainly it doesn't get rid of the memories and the pain, but it does something right. It's not, and it's not just writing, but it's writing and then meeting readers, like knowing that other people, that we're forming a community, you know, like solidarity. But in the moment, no, there was, but then later, after I decided, after, you know, my brain finally caught up to my life, to my body, I realized that I would obviously have to write about it. Just, yeah.
One of your gifts to your readers is your humor. You're dealing with such difficult topics, but there's so much soul in your humor as you bring the funny aspects of your family or your community. And does that come naturally, or do you go through and say, "Ooh, I have to lighten this up a bit"?
It's definitely the humor, the first part of your question, generally the humor in the book is just, it's my outlook. It's how I see the world. I see the world as very funny, very absurd, a ridiculous, tragic place, you know, filled with pain and anguish and comedy. And so I think it's just that, just kind of organically, naturally, that would be the, you know, that would just, that my writing would be a reflection of how I see the world. But also the second part of your question, there is, you know, in the process of writing, definitely where I think, okay, now we need to, I like to keep my readers, you know, on their toes, you know, like it's a ride, it's entertainment in a sense, it's like where it's a visceral, palpable kind of experience, so and surprise, you know, so here we are in a dark place in the narrative, and then I can say to myself, okay, I think right now I need to, like right here, the juxtaposition of something that's comic, you know. But that the comedy or the humor is not a distraction from the dark subject. Never a distraction. It's simply a tool. It's just another tool to tell the same story. Thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think about that. I don't. I feel as though I'm always thinking about my readers. Always. That for me, the act of writing is an act of reaching out, of communicating, of connecting with other human beings. You know, that essential, probably the most essential thing that we need to do in our lives. So I always, you know, imagine my readers. You know, always that it's something But at the same time, you know, I'm trying to craft a narrative. So it also then requires a kind of detachment, a little bit, enough time that passes between what I'm writing about and the present, and a kind of detachment, so that you can craft narrative, so that you can make art. It can't be like a diary, a kind of incoherent, you know, chaotic expression of pure emotion. I mean, it seems like that. Yolandi probably seems to be doing that most of the time, but in fact, it's crafted and it's paced and it's, you know. So I've never kept a diary. Actually, I've tried to keep a diary. I've tried and failed. You know, I always get a little self-conscious because I'm writing things. Maybe it's, again, maybe I, you know, I'm just assuming that somebody's going to read it or something. But I tried to keep a diary many years ago before I became a writer, and I would write things that, you know, I'm so sad. I am so angry. Why doesn't my friend talk to me anymore? It just seems so dull and ridiculous. It wasn't good writing. So I stopped and just, I take everything and I just put it into my work. Yeah. Yeah, what are my primary, why do I write what I write? In, you know, considering that there are so many different things to write about, and like you say, we all have so many ideas at once, and how are we ever going to settle on what we're going to write? Again, that's such a good question. I take a lot of notes, and a lot of notes, and at this point, I try to have faith. I try to have faith in my own creative mind. There's a large part of my mind that isn't creative, but in that creative part of it, and so as I'm living, experiencing, feeling, thinking, observing, listening, you know, I'm writing, I'm just kind of taking notes, whatever comes to me as a note that I think I should, and I write it down and I write it down, and I spend a lot of time just taking notes before I actually start the writing. And then I go over those notes and I can see patterns, emerging patterns. I can repetition of certain things that I'm going to again and again and again in my thoughts, even if I'm not necessarily aware of it. And then I know, then I can trust myself, I can trust that part of me that's done that, and say to myself, that's what I need to be writing about. Those are my demons, those are the ghosts that haunt me, those are my obsessions, and then I know. And then I need to somehow have a kind of a story, a loose thread of a story to kind of, you know, transpose those feelings onto. Okay, oh, one more apparently, one more. Yes.
Thanks. Through this process, how do you take care of yourself? I imagine this is obviously very personal.
Yeah. How do I take care of myself during this process? I have to give that credit to my partner Eric, to my mother, to my kids, to my friends, but further to that, it is important to go in quickly and get out, you know, to write quickly, and then live and then be in the world. And it's sorry. Thank you. Thanks. So you know, Miriam's books will be in the lounge, and she will be there signing them for the next 15 minutes. And I must add, the next solo reading is by Cecily Nicholson at 10:45, right here.